Hello, and welcome to the Tavern Chat Podcast. I am your host, Eric Tenkar, your bartender in the OSR, your main proprietor at the Tenkar's Tavern blog, and this is another of our designers and makers' fireside chats. Today, I have with me Aurelian. Aurelian is a man behind the forthcoming Corio Hall of Adventures campaign setting guidebook. Aurelio. Welcome. Aurelian, sorry. You see, I told you ahead of time that Concred would get me, and it got me early. All right, folks, just so you all know, your host, your bartender, is suffering from a bit of a Concred. Right now it's limited to a head cold and six packs a day smoker voice. But, hey, could be worse. All right, so let's get this going, sir. Aurelian, tell us about your... see, I got it right this time. Don't you laugh now.
Yeah, that was perfect.
I'm going to fuck it up later. By the way, it is an adult language podcast. I'll drop the F-bombs. And you're free to drop them, too. I don't care. But tell us about your first RPG experience.
So, yeah, that was a long time ago. That was AD&D, I think, second edition. A friend of mine invited me to play a game. At the time, I didn't know anything about it, and I joined in. There was a bunch of his friends there, so I got to meet a bunch of new people. And then, without explaining much of what it was, just helped me create a character sheet, and then I became the best runaway elf in the group, because I didn't know constitution was so important. So I just had a terrible, terrible HP, top HP, and then I had to just keep jumping in trees or do anything that didn't get me killed in one blow. But yeah, that was the first time. It was fun, and it was overnight, I think, if I remember well.
Okay.
So those were cool. That was really cool.
I like the fact that you did not realize that charisma is supposed to be your dump stat. That's actually pretty entertaining.
Yeah, so I think if I remember well, all these guys had played it almost every weekend all the time, and I just came in because I knew this one friend, and I guess they had all these ways of playing where they knew exactly what they had to do, so they just go. So when they said, "Okay, here's your character sheet," there was no explanation coming with it. So
okay. Yeah.
Terrible constitution. I think I was a ranger elf, which
okay.
A very, very weak ranger elf.
Ah, well, you know, and you stuck around. That's the great part about it.
That's why I fell in love with Dungeons and Dragons, because it simply became for me until much later. So I think I came back to it. I jumped 3.5, I jumped 4, and I came back to it after that. It was already 5e, because I did a lot of traveling. So during the time, I kept moving around and didn't get to play much. But at the time, it was just sitting around with a bunch of, at the time, people that became friends. And with no interruptions, just us having a good time. And that was really cool. Really, really cool. So the weakness of my character became a joke more than anything else.
Hey, whatever works, man. And again, you stuck with it, so it worked okay.
Yeah. Yep.
All right, so you came in with 2E. I came in with first edition myself. What is your go-to RPG system and why?
Now it's definitely 5E. I'm more of a adventure storytelling kind of player. I'm not as much into trying to get the best out of the points and mechanics and everything.
Right.
So 5e really streamlines that. 2e is very far back, so I don't remember much about playing with it. And I had a group I played with 3.5, so that was 3-4 years ago, I think. And with 3.5, we spent a huge chunk of the time trying to work out each turn. Especially one of the guys loved to play with all the mechanics and everything. I think it was a barbarian at the time. And right. it could blow 92 points of damage in one go. But jeez. It was huge, but it took him, I think, easily 6 to 10 minutes each time to get his thing done, because he went through every single detail of what he could do. And to me, it was slowing down the game too much, whereas 5e, it's really about playing more than looking at every single little detail that can really increase the capacity of your character.
Well, that certainly... Slow game sessions are never fun, especially when you have a large number of players at the table.
Right.
If one person's taking even 5 minutes to get their turn done, and you've got six players all doing the same, you've wasted half an hour just for the players' combat for one round.
For one
round. And even if it's half that time, even if it's 15 minutes, how many combats can you get in if it takes 3 rounds to determine a combat? The DM's taken, we'll be generous, for him, 5 minutes. You got an hour per combat, there's three. Yeah. That's why I like the old school systems, and I'd say old school, even going before 2E, stuff like Swords and Wizardry and Labyrinth Lord, which emulate Basic and White Box, because they play quickly. Not as detailed. Yeah. If 5E plays quicker than its predecessors, its immediate predecessors, that's for sure. And you also don't have the issue that I saw with Pathfinder, which was planning out 20 levels of advancement and what all your abilities that you need to take to get to where you want to go. That kind of didn't work in my mind, because I always thought of playing D&D or role-playing games as getting to your next, I don't know, sweet spot, not thinking about your sweet spot at the end of the campaign, I guess.
Right.
Every step you need to take to get there. I don't know.
Well, in the end, it's a story, right? That's why those books are wonderful, because you have a full-on story, and you're the people who get to live it instead of just reading it. But stories need bits. They need to move forward. They need to always make something happen. You can't be stuck several hours into this one encounter. So I think 5e does a really good job at keeping it interesting, but still keeping things moving.
That's cool. All right, now you came in with second edition. Did you ever have a chance to play Basic D&D?
No.
Box set? All right.
I really want to.
Because Basic D&D has a concept that you don't have in AD&D or the later editions, and that is, they put race as class. So if you're playing an elf, you're actually playing the class called elf, which is like a fighter magic user. If you're playing a dwarf, you're playing a fighter. It's like a dwarven trappings. How would you feel playing a class like that? Where all dwarves are the same, all elves are the same, except for their statistics, really.
I don't think I would mind it, because I find myself kind of doing that unconsciously. I love elves for classes that are more svelte. So let's say like a ranger or a sorcerer or a wizard. And then I will go for more of a fighter when it comes down to dwarves or humans. So I think there's an automatism there that wouldn't really bother me. I would have to try.
A little self-selecting already going on. Makes sense.
Yeah.
All right. Next question. Where do you stand on save or die as a mechanic in your RPGs?
So I haven't come across that so far. From what I understand is, for instance, if you drink poison, you roll. If you save, good for you. If you don't save, you die. That's what it is, right?
That is very correct.
Okay. So I play for playing, personally. So if I end up in a situation where I don't really get a chance to play longer than what one roll of dice, I would kind of be upset a little bit, I guess. I would want a chance to survive that kind of situation. I'm not sure that I would want to play with it. I guess it's great to have it as an option for the DM who wants to create a certain atmosphere in the group playing. But as a player, I'm not sure I would enjoy that so much.
Yeah, I'm very fond of saying that I acknowledge that Save or Die has its place. It's like spice. You know, a little bit goes a long way. I've played in game sessions where like every other room was a saving throw versus poison or a death trap or some other crap. And it gets old really fast. At the same time, if your player has to have no risk of death, that can get old too. But I always felt that they should know there's a risk coming. There's a risk and reward coming up. And you know what? This trap looks really deadly. And the reward looks really awesome. And you make that decision as opposed to you turn a corner, you step on a pressure plate, save or die. I can't do that one. It has to have some kind of greater meaning in the adventure to use that mechanic in my mind. But
right, yeah, no, that makes complete sense. It, you kind of have to see death coming. I feel like it puts a lot more pressure on the players. Whereas, yeah, if it just come out of nowhere, then it's a bit of a wasted tool. I can see where you're coming from, yeah.
All right, and then we're going to get to our final question before we move on to our little bit of a hex crawl. How old were you when you came into gaming, did you say?
So that was 90s, I guess. Did I drive? I can't remember. Somewhere around 14. 14, 15, 17.
All right, so this question fits. What would the teenage you think if they could see what you would be accomplishing in a hobby by this point in your life? You know, you've got a campaign setting guidebook that you're putting together and getting ready to publish. That 14-year-old you that came into this hobby rolling probably a charisma of like 6. What would that teenage you think of if they could see you now?
Wow, that's really profound. I don't know. I think that would come as a big surprise because at that time, it was really just, for me, it was just hanging out with friends more than playing the game itself. But then what grew out of it is the game's ability to foster my imagination. Because being able to visualize as a group an adventure and then come up with solutions to problems that can be absolutely anything, really anything. That's the beauty of Dungeons and Dragons.
Right.
So really fostering that creativity and that leading to what I'm doing now. It would be both impressive and very alien to me, I guess, at the time, simply because I come from very small countryside. Where none of this, me writing a book would not even be possible in my mind. It was not part of what reality is able to give me at the time, simply because it was so far from the state of mind that people are where I come from.
Right.
So it would be more of a, wow, how did you get there? What happened in between now and there? And
well, then that's, it would be a conversation. Well, see, that's cool. I've asked this question, like I told you today, everybody that I've sat down and had these chats with, and almost universally, everybody's like, damn, I never really thought of that question. And I hadn't thought of it. I had to look back at myself and say, what was, you know, the kid in sixth grade that, you know, played his first one-on-one adventure with his best friend at the time, think if he could see what I'm doing now. And I think lack of comprehension, and not just because, you know, I always dreamed but never thought I'd be involved in a hobby in a quasi-professional sense. But when I was a kid, and I'm sure when you were a kid, electronic publishing was not a thing. Who, yep. You know, everything was laid out by hand. Look at your, you know, old Player's Handbook and DMG, podcasting, blogs, the internet, all this opened up the potential for people to be involved in the hobby without having to pretty much relocate. I mean, look at the old TSR. Everybody lived in Lake Geneva at the time. They were, you know, now you can have companies that have their employees around the world. You can telecommute and have conferences. It's a totally different playing field. It's much more level one, I think, much more open to you don't need to have all the skill sets to get into the publishing side of the hobby anymore. And I think that's huge.
When I listen to you, it sounds really hopeful in a way. But in another way, it always brings me back to that joke that I do with people from 2000. And I tell them, you know, you get old when the phone that you used to have in your house did. Right. And it feels the same way. It's a completely pre-internet world that we're talking about right now. And it feels like it was ages ago.
It does. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, too. I like to keep a little bit of reality around, and you're talking about a rotary phone. I still have this was my grandmother's house, this apartment really, and I still have the original Bell Labs wall-mounted black, because it only came in black and I think off-white, rotary phone. And, you know, I always look at it, and it brings you back to that reality of, you know what? Wasn't too long ago before this was our internet. This was our way to communicate outside of our house. And, you know, before that, what did you have? Probably the neighborhood bar or pub where you had to go down to and get the latest gossip.
Letters. You know, latest news,
letters, newspapers. I mean, I'm in New York City. It's hard to track down a newspaper most days if you wanted to. But yeah, it's the world has greatly changed. And yet at the same time, you can easily just flip that coin and see people nowadays, like my son. My son grew up with a rotary phone. I don't think he's ever used it. He's 25. He's 25. I don't think he knows how to do anything other than pick up the handle on it. And even that, it's the house phone, and who answers the house phone? Always, you know, somebody trying to sell you something.
You should tell him that these days, between Twitter and, well, I mean, all the social media, it's really easy to hate on each other for any reason. But at the time, it was a lot simpler than that. All you had to do to be hated on was to have a 9 in your phone number.
Oh, God. Yeah.
That's it. Got a 9? Like, not calling you.
It's like, it's going to take forever to come back around. Oh, jeez. And that's true. And with my son, I remember back when I started getting into VTTs, virtual tabletops, and that was probably close to 10 years ago. And I remember him coming by my computer and looking at me and looking at the fantasy grounds with the tokens and the maps. And he goes, "What's that?" I told him, "Oh, yeah, I'm playing Castles and Crusades, like Dungeons and Dragons." He's like, "Yeah, it's not graphical enough." I'm like, "Huh?" Because that's what he grew up on. He grew up on video games, computer games, the graphics. And I'm trying to explain to him, well, you know, you're filling a lot with your head, or you can play this at the regular table. My son has never played a session of D&D in his life. His fiance, that was a 5e player. I don't know how that worked. I asked her. Friends from work, she got in, and they play on a virtual tabletop, roll 20. But my son will have nothing to do with it. He needs to get immersed in those graphics. I guess I prefer to get immersed in my imagination. I guess that's the flip of the coin there.
But you can easily argue that it's the same thing. It's just triggered differently.
You can.
The beauty of gaming on the video games is that you can immerse yourself in there just by yourself. Whereas for Dungeons and Dragons, you will always need a bunch of people around. These days, very sadly, because so with this campaign setting, I was hoping to be gaming all the time to try and get people to tell me what they think about it. But when you live in a city like Seoul, where people are constantly either working or they're on meetings or they're doing this and that, it's really hard to get actually five or six people around to play regularly. I find it really, really difficult unless you have the schedule and no kids. I'm sure you know what that means.
Oh, yes, I certainly do.
It becomes really tricky. So video games, and even for video games, I don't really have the time. But if you can find a bit of time, it's easier to immerse in the video game than in a game of Dungeons and Dragons. But you will agree that immersing yourself in a session of Dungeons and Dragons is way more rewarding, I would think.
I like to think so too. Now, I'm just going to touch on that briefly because my old gaming group from high school and college, which we broke up as a face-to-face gaming group. Oh my God. Closing on 25 years now, but we always kept in touch. So when EverQuest came out, we were playing EverQuest, Anarchy Online, City of Heroes, never did Warcraft. And then as my time with family and work and getting involved in doing things like blogs, I realized I could only do so much when it comes to, you know, free time. So then I stopped doing the online gaming. Mm-hmm. And last year, we all still talk. My friends are like, hey, we want to get back into playing D&D. 5e looks really cool. So, Eric, can you be, do you want to run it? So I'm like, okay, well, if we can actually get a night together and it's set time. No. They want DM on demand. They wanted to be played pretty much like, all right, is everybody free in like 30 minutes for an hour or two? And I'm like, dude, I can't run a game like that. I got to be prepped for it. I can't just jump into it. But that is how their mindset is now. If we can all get together in 15 minutes and hang out for an hour and a half and do a raid or finish whatever, they want to do that with their virtual tabletop. And I was amused by it. But I'm like, there's no way I could ever do that. So
that sounds like a meme where the top image is you preparing a huge campaign, and then when you get there and you meet them and they go, okay, let's play for 30 minutes.
Yeah, let's get for 30 minutes, and then we'll check in tomorrow and see if everybody has a free block of 30 to 60 minutes or more. Can't do that. Yeah. But now in like in your case, and we're, you know, with the Coil Hole of Adventures, mm-hmm. you're working on something here that is, from what I'm looking at, it's a setting, but really what it is, it's a location within a setting to get your adventurers together, to kick off adventures, to give adventure seeds out. I like the idea. Tell me more.
Right, and That's exactly the way I set it up. It's that it's a campaign setting where everything starts from one location, which is the Hall of Adventures. What I'm trying to achieve is having a setting that is sufficiently complete with enough triggers all around the realms for people to start wherever they want if they choose to. But it's really arranged in a way that it should always start at the Coil Hall of Adventure. The idea is to get a really good book out so that I can transform that then in a transmedia project. So I can keep the players and the DMs involved all the time. One way to do that, for instance, is a job alert on Instagram, let's say. And then the job alert would be a explanation, a short adventure hook that people can use for quick one-shots, like for your friends, for example. They might enjoy that.
They probably would.
You would basically be able to free flow based on that adventure arc. But then if you want something more complete, then I'm also planning to release full adventures.
So you're trying to cover all bases in a way, because you know some GMs thrive on the hook. They're not looking for extreme details. They want that seed that they can then take their own. And some GMs want something that's much more fleshed out that they can read and run with. And I don't know too many GMs that are. I mean, I can do either, but I'm much more comfortable with the hook and run for the most part. And I'm going to tell a real quick confession here. I ran three sessions of Rappanathic Mouth of Doom at GaryCon. And although I was holding the adventure notes printed out in my hand, and I would make a show of going through those notes, not one encounter was from those notes. It was all sketched out in my head ahead of time. I kind of knew where I wanted to go, but I wanted to make sure my players, especially at a convention game, which I run differently than a tabletop game, I want my players constantly involved. I don't want them to have too much of a chance to think, especially when using 3D terrain where they can metagame. I like to keep them totally focused on the here and now, and not, oh shit, if we go to that corner, we'll find the stairs that lead to the other stairs, to a separate part of the dungeon, and we'll get our goal. I want them floundering, but I want them engaged. If I was running a campaign with my players, there's where I'm looking for more fleshed out adventures, because each adventure will lead to the next. There's got to be some internal consistency, which I don't have to worry about at conventions.
Right, and that's the big difference, is what are you looking to do in each setting? In a conference, more often than not, people come to just have this one good game that's going to be fun, that's going to be moving fast, because you have slots that you have to fill in and then move on. Right. So you can riff. And when you say that you have a confession to make, and you say that, that's not a real confession, because in the end, what do you bring to the table? How many decades of experience do you bring to the table to be able to do that? Right? It's not like somebody who's been doing it for 6 months and then say, okay, let's take this and improvise. And chances are it's not going to go too well. But what really made me fall in love with the idea of the Hall of Adventures is, as an adventurer, I want, and I said I want as if I was an amateur right now, but if I imagine myself as an adventurer, it would be a wonderland to just walk into this place filled with people who are ready to go on an adventure. And then there's this huge jobs board, which is the concept here. And then you have all these job offers that you can take. And some of them are easy, you don't make much money out of them. And some of them are very difficult, so you can or cannot take it depending on your level. But also, and that's part of the history behind the hall, is that the hall itself has to sustain the ability to run itself. And in order to make more money, it had to choose to take good action jobs and not so good action jobs, like assassinations and anything. So basically, the idea behind the whole is you could do absolutely anything, in the sense that on one side, you can go and help people, or you can choose to be a very, very good assassin and just go around and kill people for money. So that's the idea, is that the whole has a space for everybody.
And well, yeah. I liked it. No, I like it too, but as a default, aren't your player characters, as you describe them, assassins? Because they kill people for money. They're not necessarily getting paid to kill people, but they're certainly making money for clearing out a dungeon after killing tons of shit. And being an assassin isn't too much different. Except that somebody's paying you ahead of time, maybe.
Right. I would say that the... on the more positive side of the jobs available at the hall, the hall is based on a setting that is based on animism. So there's no gods. It's all spirits of different strengths, right?
Okay.
So everything has a spirit in the on this setting, and they have positive spirits and malevolent spirits. And a lot of the things that will commonly happen for lower, more positive types of jobs is going to a town that is being bothered by malevolent spirits. So you're going to have to go through the town and find ways to find these spirits, try to track down where they are, because you can't see them, their spirits. And then once you found them, then you need to expel them from the village. And that would be a very simple job. In this case, nobody has to get hurt, just those spirits are getting kicked out. So that would be a more simple one. Then the more ambivalent ones, where indeed you have to kill people in order to get things done. You get attached to this reputation system where we all have this gray area where we're willing to accept. And that's something that I'm hoping people can think about as in real life and adventure life. Are you willing to accept that these people are going to die in order to achieve a good thing? And then it's up to you and up to the GM to decide yes or no. And that will play on your reputation points. And the higher you go, the more you can get good, positive adventures. And the lower you go, and the more you're on the dark side of adventures, if you want to say it like this.
Right.
And then you will have access to those really horrible jobs, or you can have access to those really amazing jobs. So, yes, I think you're right. When you kill people, may it be for money or not, you can be qualified as assassin, but we are all willing to accept some kind of death for some kind of result.
True. I guess it's why they call play characters a lot of times murder hobos, because they're always traveling and they're always killing. And and I guess in a way, they're not just traveling to find new people to kill, but they're traveling to get away from the families or the clans or whatnot of the people they killed prior. So it's a good reason for them to keep on the road and keep moving, keep adventuring to different places. I never thought of it quite like that until right now. And yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I really like the idea that, so something that I didn't get to test yet, but that really looks interesting in my head is, for example, in conventions. Conventions, I've seen a lot of people saying that some groups go really well and some groups don't always go too well, because some players are willing to go in places that other people didn't expect to go. And what I like with this system is that you could actually say as a GM, this is going to be a negative reputation adventure where things are going to go dark. Or you can say, this is going to be a positive adventure where everything... Of course, you can't avoid having this and that, talking about death and killing. This is part of the game, of course. But overall, this adventure is being pushed towards a good result. And you'll be able to say that up front, and that allows player to choose tables where it's, okay, here I might not go to a dark place that I'm not willing to go. So this reputation system really helps for that.
Well, that's actually pretty cool. That's a nice little... what's the word I'm looking for here? This is what happens when, you know, you're fighting off a head cold. Your head gets really slow when it comes to thinking. It's a nice little addition to it. It's a nice little extra facet to the game. I like that.
I hope so. I hope it works, because those kind of things can only work if they are being embraced by people. If the GM thinks that, oh, whatever, I don't need this, then the item becomes useless, right? But if people think it's a good idea, I'm hoping it could help in some ways, getting the games more flowy and enjoyable for those who are willing to go some places and others who are not.
Right, and it also, you know, adds an additional layer to your campaign. If you have a reputation that follows you around, get to your next location, people might expect you to be heroes. They might, you know, pull back and whisper. But based upon if you're keeping track of that reputation, you can add that. I mean, that's pretty good. Now, this is going to be kickstarted, right? Is that the plan?
Yeah. The idea is to kickstart next month.
Oh, next month? Nice. All right.
Yeah, in April. So the manuscript is all done. When I pick up a book, I've got very high expectations of what I will find in there. And Wizards of the Coast always delivers because those books are beautiful, right? So I want to be able to provide the same kind of quality, which is definitely not cheap, especially with illustration and everything. So that's why I wanted to go through Kickstarter. The manuscript by itself could just be delivered quite easily, but I really want to make this beautiful book that people will get and say, oh, wow, that's cool.
Yeah, we've actually had like discussions about that with like Douglas Cole on our Discord server, because he's somebody else who only, you know, he's the man that fights to, you know, upgrade the paperweight by another 20 pounds because he's made a little bit, you know, his Kickstarter did a little bit better, and that's one of the stretch goals. And yeah, he put out some beautiful books. So I'm looking forward to what you got. Now, you've done something that a lot of people haven't done, and that's you've actually written your project before you plan to kickstart it. And that in and of itself is one of the things that you need to do to guarantee success after funding. A lot of people feel that they're going to kickstart it and that's going to pay them to write it. And it's nice to see that you've already written it. So now that's the biggest hurdle. That's the biggest hurdle for any Kickstarter, is to actually have something. I mean, like, you can use Kickstart funding to upgrade the art, or, you know, get some really good pieces of art. That's what I think Joe Block does that with his stuff. His Kickstarters are always there to fund the art. He writes it ahead of time. And the better the Kickstarter does, the more art pieces he can commission. And I think that's...
In my case, it makes complete sense because have you ever heard of me before we got in touch for the podcast?
No, I had not. To be honest with you, no.
Yeah, so what's the... Why should I be entitled to get money from anybody if you have no idea who I am, right? That makes no sense. It has to have a more practical purpose. It's disconcerting to me that people who've haven't proved what they can do or haven't provided something would ask for money in order to write something. It sounds a bit odd in my head. Nobody heard from me before, so it's just fair that I do the work first and then get the Kickstarter going for something that actually will improve the already finished product.
That to me is awesome. I cover Kickstarters a lot, especially on the blog side, and I've backed, my wife's at work, I can say this, I've backed over 300 over the years.
Wow.
And it slowed down since I retired, because once you can no longer make overtime and night diff to pad your money, you have to make a bit better choices. And maybe you're not going to get the home automated cider brewing machine. Maybe you'll settle on backing somebody's fanzine. But one of the things that the early Kickstarter movement was, it was really literally based on dreams and visions, and I have this great idea, and this is the idea I want to go with, and I've got this for example, Far West Garish Arca, who wanted to do this Asian American West mashup, and it is 7 3 months late. So that tells you he had a great idea and a great concept, but he had nothing written. And when you have something written already, you're pretty much telling your potential backers, listen, I've done the grunt work. I've done the hard part. I've actually written a product that I'm kickstarting. Like you said, I just want to make it better. That's where you come off of somebody that's competent right out of the gate. And maybe you're not going to get $250,000. Maybe you're not going to do 7 C levels. You know, there's other people who dreamed about hitting those levels and then got nowhere near. Yeah. We're not going to get into that. But knowing what you need to make to make sure that you don't lose money is your next step. Like, you have to have a funding level that's not going to cost you out of pocket. And probably the next big thing, and I think this one is huge, if you have stretch goals, they shouldn't add to your actual cost of you as the creator putting into this Kickstarter. Adding extra pages to a book or a PDF is fine. Adding a new book, adding mugs, pins, pencils, whatever, all has a cost associated with it.
Right.
It's easier to add material to your actual book that you're writing than it is to add additional items to your project. In the end, it's a lot cheaper to do it to your book.
Right. Well, I think I'm somewhere right in between, because the one thing that I would love to be able to achieve with this Kickstarter is there's one stretch goal, which is a canonical adventure for this setting, meaning that I would like to be able to get to a point in the funding that first, of course, the book, and second, and that's a second stage, of course, it's not the most important,
right,
but second stage would be to get this four parters adventure out to the backers throughout 1 or 2 years. I need to review what's the timing there, but throughout 1 or 2 years, and this would become canonical, meaning that the setting itself would be completely changed by the end of the story.
Okay, now here I am becoming like a Kickstarter advisor. Are you going to put this stuff out in print or PDF?
The additional would be PDF.
All right, because I'm thinking back to another Kickstarter from Brave Halfling, and he did all these stretch goals for additional adventures for DCC, mm-hmm. and I think in the end he had, I don't know, 6 or 8 adventures planned, but he was like shipping them all separately in print.
Okay.
And long story short, I think we're 5 years later, and some people still haven't gotten their initial adventures. He realizes now he's not going to be putting them all out. Especially in the States, shipping has gone up hugely. But, you know, if you're putting stuff out in PDF, you avoid certain costs. Even if it's a PDF with a print-on-demand coupon attached to it, you're good. But once you start having to handle shipping on your own side, especially for additional items, you're chewing up whatever profits you made and then some. And I hate it. What I hate more than seeing a Kickstarter successfully fund and then not be able to ship is one that successfully funds and then the creator loses money on it getting it out. And I've seen that too. And God bless them for eating that. But they shouldn't have to. They never should have gotten to that.
Yeah, so, no, definitely. And I don't want to be dependent on minimum units. If for the book, I have to get a minimum number of units printed if I want to be able to do it.
Because right.
That's just how printers work, right? But I don't want to have that limitation with the adventures. Because it is a huge pressure both on budget and on ability to deliver. But if it's a stretch goal, for instance, that will be delivered in PDF and that is not the main book, I can do a lot of concessions. I can get art done in black and white because it's not as problematic.
Or stock art. You know, you have a lot of options out there.
Yeah. So, the book is the main priority. If the Kickstarter does really, really well, I think that story is going to be my next priority because it's already all laid out in my head. I just have to get it down on paper.
Yeah. I know how dangerous it is having things laid out in your head because I got way too much stuff that I'd love to work on. And yeah, that's, oh boy. All right. Well,
luckily, writing is my full-time job, so it fits. It's not like I'm stretching myself here. It's more.
No, it fits you like a glove. It's what you do. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Hello, Rowan. I think we're gonna wrap up today's episode. This was really good.
Yeah,
I'm gonna remind you right now. Since Kickstarter is kicking off next month in April. Remind me. I might take a nice look at your Kickstarter page. I want to get a chance to mention it on the blog. And I really, it looks good. And even though I don't play much 5e, I can certainly finagle it to fit any system I want. Nearly 40 years of GM experience is like that. Yeah. And I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm happy you like it so far.
Definitely. All right, folks, we're going to wrap this up. Thank you for listening. I appreciate it. Really appreciate it. April 1st Kickstarter, I will remind people both here and on the blog side. As always, stay safe, be well. God bless. Roll those dice, and I will talk with you all tomorrow. Later, folks.